Thank you so much for making time to come to this town meeting. I must say that the planning committee for the ethics and interrogation sessions of this convention, component of convention, felt that it was really important to have a town meeting, a space for people, psychologists, to come together, to have a dialogue, to share thoughts, to share opinions across the association in this way, where we are all here together in person, face to face. So that you have come and taken advantage of that opportunity, and I think others will be trickling in, I think is simply wonderful. I hope that you've been able to attend some of the sessions that have been planned for the Ethics and Interrogations series, because we very, very carefully assembled that series to offer an opportunity for a sharing of knowledge, a sharing of science, a sharing of very thought-provoking issues and concerns in this area. We were hoping for both breadth and depth, and hopefully we have accomplished that. In this setting, we want all thoughts and opinions represented here to be heard. So if you have a thought that you'd like to share, if you have an issue you'd like to raise, we hope that you will raise it. And we hope that if you have the mic, that you will respectfully raise your opinion, and those who are listening will respectfully listen to you. My colleague, Dr. Doug Haldeman, I don't think I introduced myself. I'm Olivia Moorhead Slaughter. Sorry about that. I have been a part of the Ethics Committee. I'm currently a part of BAPI, the Board for the Advancement of Psychology in the Public Interest. I chaired the PENS Task Force. I have continued to work on this effort, and side by side with many colleagues who have worked tirelessly around these issues, and we shall continue to do so. But thank you again for coming, and Doug Haldeman, my colleague from the Board of Directors, and I will be co-moderating this session, and we welcome you here.
Good afternoon, everybody. I just wanted to make a brief comment about logistics. Obviously, this is not ideal that we have one microphone, and so I would ask that we invite your comments in whatever way is most convenient and practical. And one thought, of course, is to come up to the podium. The other is simply to stand on the floor in front. And if people feel comfortable doing that, that's probably a little bit easier than everybody getting up on the general sense of what you would prefer to come to the podium and have the podium to lean on when you talk.
Many people may project.
Okay. The other is that we are going to ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes. That is because there are many of you here, and we want to ensure that as many of you who would like to speak are able to do so. And I will be the timekeeper, and I'll give you a signal when you have 30 seconds left, and then I will give you another signal when it is time to stop. And with that, yes, any questions, comments about the format? Yes, sir.
Could you just brief us on what council voted on today before we go to the bylaw?
I'd be happy to do that. There's a lot of history that I'm going to leave out so that there is more time for people to talk. But what went on to the council agenda was a motion, a substitute motion from the board of directors that attempted to create a sort of compromise position, if you will, from what was initially the moratorium resolution that was developed by Dr. Neil Altman and the subsequent feedback from the boards of committees that came in the springtime. This solution felt was, at least for what it was, an adequate one. But when we all got together, we realized that there were a number of stakeholders who had yet to really sit down at the table and talk together and work out a solution to the question of psychologists' involvement in interrogations in places where detainees are held without adequate or any civil rights and human rights. The group that crafted the resolution that was ultimately passed today was one that included the Military Psychology Division, the Peace Psychology Division, the representatives from the Divisions for Social Justice, representatives from the New York State Psychological Association, and a number of other divisions, including consulting and counseling, and some consultation as well from the Ethics Committee. That resolution passed and is a document that is too long for me to summarize here, but included all collaboration between these groups with the exception of the clause that would be location-specific in terms of prohibiting psychologists from working at certain detention centers. I would say it's fair to say that although this the resolution itself passed nearly unanimously, the amendment itself brought a fairly divided sense to the Council of Representatives, where there were many people who came down on the side of we withdraw completely from these kinds of settings, because to participate implies a complicity, as I understand it, with governmental policies that we find abhorrent and unjust to people. There was, however, a larger group of people who felt that we stay engaged and that we cannot be helpful by not bearing witness and by offering whatever consultation and help that we can to people who are conducting interrogations. And that is the basic gist of how it went today at council. Okay. Any further questions about the logistics or that? Thanks, Rhoda. Yes, please identify yourself, state your name, and whatever affiliation you would like to connect with that. Yes, sir.
Would you like us just to form a line so we can take turns?
I would, so that we're not waiting for people to come up and grab the mic. I'm sorry, could they go here?
Speak up there.
Could they speak on the podium? Podium's okay. We're getting a request from the reporter here that you speak at the podium. Is that all right? Okay. The concern is that there is no step here, so let me know if you...
Step on this side.
Okay, if you would form your line starting there, over there, and please come up.
My name is Dr. Rhona Fields. I've been evaluating, studying, examining torture victims all over the world since 1970. In 1972, I gave an interview to the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. I was then on the Committee on Social and Ethical Responsibility for Psychology at the beginning of it, and I said that psychology has to take responsibility for the way its tools, in other words, its experiments, its research, its findings are used, as nuclear scientists did on the atomic bomb. This is our atomic bomb. In response to this, the then president of scientific affairs ordered me censured, and I was subsequently dismissed from the Committee on Social and Ethical Responsibility, which is no big deal because they didn't do anything except to say that sensory deprivation is sometimes very helpful. This appears, by the way, in the Congressional Record, February 16, 1972. It is therapeutic. It is therapeutic and causes no harm except when it's done to infants and old people. Okay? And on that basis, they pointed out that there were at least 30 journal articles on sensory deprivation, all by reputable psychologists, including Hebb and Swayfeld and others, and that these were legitimate science. All right, the story hasn't changed. The story is the same today. At this point, I have examined thousands of people in Argentina, in Chile, in Northern Ireland, in Israel, in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Southeast Asia, in South Asia, as well as refugees coming here for asylum who have been tortured in many, many other places. The point isn't to diss the military. The point is that the association has got to take responsibility. In all of these other places, there are civilian psychologists participating in the torture. And there certainly were in Northern Ireland. And when you try to do therapy with torture survivors or even interview and test them, and you are a psychologist, you're one of the people who tortured them. Okay, thank you. That I can give you a bibliography of things I've written that have been published in academic presses, but that's the gist of it, and I'd like to start the discussion on that issue.
I'm Dr. Uwe Jacobs. I'm the clinical director of Survivors International, a rehabilitation organization for survivors of torture. I have done some work over recent months and further back to help with this process of bringing, hopefully, to pass a resolution that would call for a stop to psychologists participating in military detention centers. In terms of a compromise, I am not all that happy today, and the reason is that, for starters, the moratorium itself, which is what we all were trying to get to pass, was defeated. I think there are many other points that are also important, but that are not the main point. The main point is that as a non-governmental organization, which should be beholden to international law, nevertheless, the APA has decided to side with this government and its own domestic laws where they diverge from international law. That's a big problem. In terms of some specifics, my experience was, unfortunately, that to the degree that we were trying to be specific about things that are not allowed, the other side, as it were, from within the APA, kept pushing back so that, for example, where we felt it was important to have in this resolution that the conditions of detention are identified, not just interrogation processes, that suggestion was taken back out. That's only one example. The reason why that is so important is because at this point nobody really needs to interrogate people much anymore in these places. But the conditions of detention themselves have been called tantamount to torture by the ICRC and other observers. And so it is very difficult for me to understand why some people within the organization would take precisely that kind of language away from a resolution like this if there isn't the intent to make sure that some people aren't going to get into trouble.
My name is Dan Albers, and I am just another psychologist who thinks that the moral issue of our time has landed at our doorstep. I wanted to say just a few things. One, I think that there has not been today, or in these last number of years, enough discussion about the difference between the culture of science and the culture of an intelligence community. Scientists are committed to openness. Ultimately, what keeps us ethical is not our ethical code, is not our internal review boards, but it is that we publish our research We present things at conferences. And ultimately, the last test on whether or not we have been ethical or not is public scrutiny. This is very different than an intelligence organization which tends to want to control information. And there are these basic incompatibilities I think we have not addressed. The second point I want to make is about this moratorium that did not pass. We have made an enormous mistake, and I think it's not only did we do the wrong thing morally, we did not act in our best interests. We are now standing against the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association, the British Psychological Society, numerous human rights organizations, the UN, the Council of Europe, and this detention and interrogation policy is going to go down. And once it does go down, we will find that we have secured the best cabin on the Titanic. Thank you.
Bill McConaughey. I'm a psychologist from Eugene, Oregon. I served in the Army for 3 years, many decades ago, and I recall that we were instructed to refuse to obey laws or rather commands from officers above us or our sergeants that we deemed to be illegal, such as the model on the issue that was raised when Lieutenant Calley was responsible for the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. And I suggest that the APA Ethics Committee revise or craft the ethics to guide a psychologist that is working in the military setting when he is aware of or confronts a situation where his conscience or conflict between what he's asked to do and what he thinks the Constitution says is appropriate or what national laws think say are, is appropriate or what international laws say are appropriate, that the psychologist would be encouraged to recognize that dilemma and then turn to the APA Ethics Committee for counsel and guidance about how to get through it. I don't think we can just say psychologists shouldn't work for the military or shouldn't work in situations where these issues might come up. Any responsible psychologist is going to be involved in issues that occasionally become ethical dilemmas. And it's been my practice as a clinician simply not to have an answer for every one of those possible dilemmas, but to know that I can turn to my attorney and to the Oregon State Psychological Association attorney for guidance and the Ethics Committee when something like that comes up.
I'm Dr. Mark Hovey. Out of Paintsville, Kentucky. I'm also a captain in the Army Reserve. I was called up 2004 to 2005 to Germany at Longstuhl Hospital and then worked at a brigade nearby at Bonholder.
Yes, can you hear me better?
Yeah.
And during my time there, I bumped into a problem. 2004, as you may recall, was a year that Abu Ghraib broke. I just happened to have been deeply affected by that, and talking to some of my colleagues, I think some of them were deeply affected by that as well. It prompted me to write an article that on Abu Ghraib, taking it more from a psychological perspective, drawing from some different theories, also Zimbardo. And unfortunately, I didn't realize at the time that I was hitting a major landmine because when it went through the review process in order to be approved for publishing, it was denied. And I can say to you that that single event changed my life. And it prompted me ultimately to write a book since the articles that I was attempting to publish I ran into some difficulties. And so I would say Abu Ghraib was the centerpiece and the being denied publishing, that was the main feature of the book. And
I just want to say that there were some other psychologists that I worked with there who had been SEER trained. I think they were some great people. As far as I know, I don't think that they were involved in any of the goings-on with some of the psychologists that were later identified as being directly involved in, or indirectly involved in interrogation things. But I do want to say that I think that what I bumped into is a major flaw of the system. And what it is that we are bound as military people under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And so we can't simply go out and publish when we'd like to. We have to go through that process. And as I wrote in the book, I think that it's a major problem for people that are in the know, that know what's going on in the military circles, that they are prevented from being able to speak the truth and to actually help modify things so that we don't have to wait 3 years later for all of this to come out. Thanks.
Just a point of procedure. We're told that reporters are only allowed to record for 10 minutes, and Pam Wilentz of the APA said that she will call security on us now because we're going to be recording for more than 10 minutes.
Why? Why is that being done?
Or a rationale, since this is a town hall meeting, for not being allowed to record for more than 10 minutes.
It's our town hall meeting, isn't it?
We want the press to witness this.
Yeah, absolutely.
No more crimes in silence. No more secrecy.
Transparency, openness.
Open meeting.
Can everyone who approves of allowing the reporters to record please raise your hand?
Go ahead.
The recording will continue through the session. Yay!
Irene Cardenas. I am here today as a guest, but I studied social psychology under Philip Zimbardo, whose work I very much admire. And I would ask, if I am any given mental health professional and I have trouble facing traumas that I have been through, because that's the nature of trauma, how can I be expected to recognize when someone else has been traumatized to diagnose them correctly? Or is being traumatized by something that I consider psychological treatment, whether it is in a military detention facility, or in a mental hospital, or in a therapeutic setting where someone could be re-traumatized. And since we know that psychologists are humans with blind spots, is giving one person the power to determine if someone has been or is being traumatized or not, giving them amount of power that is open to abuse. Thank you.
My name is Jean Maria Arrigo. I'm a social psychologist. For 12 years, I've studied ethics of political and military intelligence, working very closely with people from the military and intelligence, in particular. In November of last year, I was one of the primary organizers of a seminar for psychologists and interrogators, one of whom I brought to this conference, Ray Bennett. And we have discussed intensively what interrogators, at least of his acquaintance, senior interrogators want of psychologists. And their message was really unambiguous, which is that they wanted the assistance of psychologists at the training level, at basic training at Fort Huachuca, places like that, not anywhere in the detention center, and that was it. So I'm here to bring the message from those interrogators.
I'm a clinical psychologist from Bellingham, Washington, and I can remember some time ago when someone asked me what psychologist's role was in interrogation, and naively I said, that's a no-brainer, none. And then I found out we are involved, and here we are, we're trying to get our organization to change. I feel like a Democrat after the last election, trying to get the politicians to respond to what we want.
Hi, I'm Diane Richmond from Santa Cruz, a clinical psychologist. I want to just say a couple things about, it seems to me the question becomes such a moot point that we don't even need to discuss whether our psychologist should be there. First, just a moment, that the American Medical Association does not have psychiatrists allowed to be at detention centers. What does that tell us? I don't think they're abdicating the responsibility to be legally and morally bound by not being there. They did not abdicate, nor would we, but by leaving. The laws are in place that we can follow and have to follow morally and legally, the international human rights laws and the Geneva Convention. States clearly that we should not be involved as psychologists. We offer mental health care. We have rules and regulations in place already. So therefore, we tell them, follow those rules and regulations. We should not be enforcing it by saying if psychologists are there, they will enforce it, because we are not lawyers, we are not enforcers. We are psychologists who have an enormous amount of data and information. So therefore, we can point to that, but we don't need to be there. We need to really find our shining moment in APA. That's a very respected organization. Many of us have been members for many years, nationally and internationally, very well respected. Let's reclaim the high road and talk about, we shouldn't even have to give credibility to whether we should be there or not when we should not be there. We should be against any kind of use of psychologists when those psychologists are violating our moral, legal, and ethical rules. We absolutely have to speak up before it's too late. And lastly, we also put that military psychologist, and I'm very respectful of those military people, in a horrible dilemma to listen to the military law, to their society law, to the international law. Which law do they follow? What a horrible dilemma. What is that doing to their mental health? And what about all the patients we see who are so traumatized by what's going on, and for people who have been experiencing this kind of... We just heard a wonderful talk about all the data about when there's a terrorist act, counterterrorism prevails. And we are contributing to all of that. It's really time we reclaim APA for the incredible organization it is, take it back in a humane, moral, legal way, and not have psychologists there at all. The laws are in place. We need to follow the laws. We have to remember, too, I'm so sorry, so much of the policy was based on deception by the White House. And I'm sorry, we have to get political. It was based on deception. That's a premise. We can't just throw away and start debating whether we should do this or that. We were lied to. Thank you. 30 seconds. We were lied to. Deception was used. They used psychology techniques to get people polarized, to get us to not listen to what's really going on, and to make us think that 9/11 and Iraq are related. I responded to 9/11 as a Red Cross responder, and they were. Everyone knows they're not related, but that premise is brought together. Again, it's repeated here today by DOD in sessions. It's if I'm listening to Fox News. It is really time that we listen to the facts and the reality and reclaim our country before we go to the ways the Argentines did or the Nazis did. Stand up now, please, I beg you. Thank you.
guest with Physicians for Human Rights. I'm a friend of APA. And what I'd like to do for a moment is talk about the fact that this resolution has been passed. There are elements in it that a lot of us don't like and some of us do like, and it's quite a mix. But the resolution has passed, and it seems that there are things the organization needs to do in response to the resolution. There are three elements of the resolution that are particularly important. One is the condemnation of 20 specific interrogation techniques that we know have been used and probably are still being used by the CIA. Second, it expresses grave concern over the fact that human rights violations are taking place in American-run detention facilities, and it recognizes that those violations include not only violations in interrogation, but in conditions of confinement. Those are all in the resolution. So what does the association need to do? I'd like to suggest there are a few things that need to be done. One is absolutely, as the resolution calls for, to condemn the CIA for using these interrogation techniques and operating black sites where there is no due process, where people are kidnapped, where people are kept incommunicado, and where the ICRC is denied access. That follows first from the resolution. That seems a bottom line. A second is, while the amendment was defeated concerning participation in places where human rights violations have been committed, it seems that the association, given the 3 points I just raised about what's in the resolution, needs to say, what is a psychologist supposed to do in a CIA black site? What is the ethical guidance that the psychologist can get from this organization, given the circumstances under which that facility is run? Third, there are going to be hearings this fall by the Armed Services Committee in the Senate. And it seems to me, and concerning the role of psychologists, including CIRA psychologists, and it seems the APA, given this resolution, has an imperative to publicly cooperate with that committee and provide whatever guidance and support it can to its investigation. Fourth, there are particular psychologists whose names we know have been identified in the public, who may or may not be members of the APA, often not, but that doesn't seem to me to be relevant, that they need to be investigated by the APA on the basis of this resolution. Finally, there has to be a way of moving forward with the general problem which was addressed in the amendment, and it goes back to the first point I made. How do you operate in an environment that is replete with human rights violations, sometimes gross violations, sometimes war crimes? These are not just violations of ethics, but they're actually war crimes which can't be prosecuted. And how psychologists, what guidance will be given to psychologists in those settings to make sure that they are not complicit in those abuses? I think that all follows from the resolution, and we at Physicians for Human Rights would be delighted to work with the association moving forward on all five counts. Thanks.
Just two quick things. One, Dr. Rubenstein, I think, raised a very important issue about what guidance APA can give. And part of the resolution that was passed was reaffirming that the Ethics Committee will be writing a casebook to help psychologists with these ethical dilemmas. The second thing I want to say is to encourage everyone here to read the resolution. There are very important issues that are being raised, and I think some of the questions about what was done in the resolution is being lost in some of the feelings about the one amendment that was not passed. So I would just like to ask everyone to please, please read the resolution that was passed. I'm not sure when it will be on the APA website, but I'm sure it'll be very soon. Does anyone know from who's here when it might be on the website? But it should be, Dr. Banky, do you know? Probably by tomorrow. So please, please read the resolution that was passed. We're focusing a lot on the amendment that was not, and there's much in the resolution that I think everyone will find being very positive. Thank you.
Mary Ann Jackson. I'm from New York, and I'm active in NISPA. And I'd like to talk to another aspect of this, what I consider a problem, and that is that as I went through the convention today, I took the time to chat with people on the bus, waiting for Bob Newhart and other kinds of places, and I was really amazed at how many people didn't know or kind of just vaguely knew what was going on here. And I agree with the man who said, this is the moral question of our time for our profession. I sincerely believe that. And I was very dismayed to see how few psychologists at this convention. I heard that there are 15,000 of us, and yet there are only a couple of hundred here. How few of them either knew the issue or understood the issue or were concerned enough to find out about the issue. Now, of course, there's the additional problem that the population in general doesn't know too much about this, and I'm very glad to see the press is here to record this and get it out because I think it's very important. But, you know, as I leafed through the division newsletters and the APA's house organ, I'm reluctant to call it our house organ because I don't think it revealed this controversy, this very important issue, to APA members. Now, those who are active and those in the social justice divisions and those of us that are kind of like seeking out what's going on are aware of it. But I think that many, many of our members just didn't know or only knew very slightly what was going on. And I'm very upset about that. I feel that our organization has to be more transparent. And I would like to see that in the coming year, we read about this in the Monitor, and we read the facts of the situation, as well as the organization's interpretation of it. So, and I would like to see that there is some action being taken, as Mr. Rubenstein from Physicians for Human Rights. Why is it that he had to tell us, okay, these are the steps you have to take? You know, I think that we have to make sure that our organization actually does take the steps that are necessary to get this resolution out to the public, out to our members, so that we can all move forward. Thank you.
My name is Mike Ahrens. I've been retired for 8 years from university. And we now spend, my wife and I now spend much of our time in Europe. And I do have relations with psychologists in Europe. So what the doctor over there just finished saying, that many of our colleagues here in San Francisco don't know much about this, I can tell you that some of the psychologists that I've known in Europe do know about this. They do read the newspapers. And this is the interesting implication, because we share the same field, even if not the same nationality, this is a reflection on everybody in psychology everywhere in the world. So decisions that you're making right here are reflecting on the entire field. Now, already, as everybody knows, already the credibility of our country, the trust in our country, the leadership in our country has bottomed out. And so this is just one more thing that lies on the top of it.
Hi, my name is Nancy Wecker. I'm in private practice in San Francisco. I just want to propose a conflict that we have. It's like we're embedded in the military. You know, like the journalists who are embedded in the war. That's our problem. Most of our internships are all in the military, DOD or mostly the VA. So I think we have this problem with ethics are really high pollutant. You know, it's hard for us to imagine people being tortured for a lot of us. And then we have our affiliation and our loyalty. So these are in conflict, and I think people couldn't imagine, you know, withdrawing from our responsibilities and our teamwork with these people in the military because of some highfalutin kind of ideals. And, it, you know, anyway, I just want to put that out. I think it's a conflict. I think people could resolve that in the way you say, well, you know, we'll take a really definite stand. So that's why it's fuzzy. Thank you.
I'm Carter Mell. I'm a psychologist, have been a psychologist in public service in Alameda County, just across the bay from here, for 27 years, and I just retired a few months ago. I'm one of the people that, I'm sorry, I don't remember the woman's name, but who was not aware of all of this very much. My brother, who's not a psychologist, about a year ago, posed the question to me, how come psychologists haven't come out the way psychiatrists, AMA, other organizations have against, you know, not participating in these kind of interrogations? And I said, yeah, I don't know anything about this. I can't believe what you're sort of implying with this. So I looked it up and I found the PENS report. And I felt very reassured. The words are very nice. It looked good. I read it pretty carefully, I thought. And I said, okay, great. I talked back to him, called him back, and said, you know, no, I don't know. You must have a misunderstanding of this. That was sort of the end of it, till he prodded me again more recently about these issues, and I began paying attention more to things that are coming out in the press. Vanity Fair issues of a recent New Yorker and so on. Anyway, I don't know quite where I stand on all this, but I have to say I am more troubled by the fact that was stated that I don't feel that the leadership of APA made this very well known among the membership. This is a huge issue. It is, I think, the central issue of our country. I have to take responsibility. I didn't dig. I will dig now. I will read this new resolution very carefully. I'm eager to see what it says. But I'm most troubled by the things. I've been attending all the sessions in this little workshop. And I was most disturbed by Gina Rigo's comments about her experience and the process of how the PENS report came about. And I have to say, I'm most disturbed at this meeting now about what we just experienced about the press is going to be cut off. Why are we being secretive? It's bad. I mean, I understand by the CIA agency. I would like someone from APA leadership to explain their rationale, why they thought a town meeting like this should be cut off, that the press should be excluded after 10 months. I would really like to know.
Answer.
Can we please have a response?
Is there someone from the staff who would like to respond to this? I mean, I would like to respond to it, I suppose, if I had known it existed, but...
Go ahead.
What do you know?
Not very much. I did not know until this session started that there was a 10-minute limit on press coverage of these sessions. And I am sorry, I cannot explain this to you because I don't know why.
Who did... Yeah, where did it come from, Doug?
The reporter here. So, while I've got the microphone, we're highlighting some other communication problems within the association. Seriously, because I truly don't know how to explain this to you. I didn't know it existed. I'm glad that it's been resolved satisfactorily.
But can I ask a question? Can I ask that you find out where that came from and then put an announcement on the APA website explaining it? Because it is now national news. I think it's a matter of transparency, face-saving explanation. It's all part of the process of trying to keep this very important issue active and alive so we can all address it as professionals.
I will put it at the top of my to-do list, sir.
Thank you.
I have told you what I can tell you about this. Do you want to continue?
Thank you, Doug.
But I think it is very important that there are decisions being made and nobody seems to know who made them. My name is Stephen Reisner. I've got a couple of questions. My first question, I just want to say that I'm sure many people in this room know that many of us are trying to grapple with the fact that the amendment wasn't passed today. And I wanted to ask this group a question. I wanted to take another vote. The amendment states that psychologists should not be participating as part of a military operation or a CIA operation at sites where human rights are being violated. And I would like to know in this room how many people would support such an amendment. How many would be opposed?
Could you say it again?
Do you have the actual wording? Here's the actual wording.
Okay, this is the wording. Be it resolved that the objectives of the APA shall be to advance psychology as a science and profession and as a means of promoting health, education, and welfare. And therefore, the roles of psychologists in settings in which detainees are deprived of adequate protection of their human rights should be limited as health personnel to the provision of psychological treatment. How many are in favor? How many are opposed? I want to know why the Council of Representatives is so different in how it votes from the members of the American Psychological Association. So that's my first question. My second question, following up on what Len Rubenstein asked. Len Rubenstein spoke about if we are taking this resolution seriously, where we have to go as an organization. I would like to pose this differently. I would like to know if we take this resolution seriously, where we are as an organization. I want to know, and there are ethicists in this room, there are people who were involved in the careful wording of this resolution. I want to know if passing this resolution prohibits psychologists from being involved in the enhanced interrogation techniques that the President of the United States authorized can take place at CIA black sites. Enhanced, the APA leadership, many of the spokespeople for the APA position have said that the APA only wants to use rapport building interrogation techniques and that these techniques do no harm. Yet the President has authorized enhanced techniques, which means that they are more aversive than those techniques that are approved even in the Army Field Manual, which are no picnic. And I want to know from people who hear, who know, the ethicists, psychologists in this room who worked on this language, does this resolution prohibit psychologists from participating in enhanced interrogations at CIA black sites? I have 30 seconds, and I want to say one more thing. We as an organization have seen the answer to this question of whether this resolution prohibits this participation goes to the essence of who we are as ethical psychologists. If we cannot say, no, we will not participate in enhanced interrogations at CIA black sites, I think we have to seriously question what we are as an organization, and for me, what my allegiance is to this organization, or whether we might have to criticize it from outside the organization at this point. I would very much like to be able to continue to call myself a member of the American Psychological Association, but it is only possible if the ethical standards of this association are something that I am willing to pay dues to.
Stephen Solds from the Coalition for an Ethical APA. I want to reiterate what Stephen Reisner just asked. This is the central question. We have been told throughout the day, throughout the week, that the APA has an unequivocal policy against torture. There is no doubt that torture is occurring in the CIA black sites. We may have some questions about what's going on in Guantanamo these days because we have know very little about the interrogation, but we know that the president has reauthorized torture. We need the leadership of the APA to state unequivocally that it is unethical for psychologists to participate in these enhanced interrogation techniques. That will be the measure of whether we got a real resolution here, or did we get scammed. So we know, we will find out, you know, we will conduct an experiment. We're scientists, we look at data. We will find out what this means. Remember that. In the next few days, the next few weeks, we need to know that. Now, to call attention to one minor detail in here, however, that I hope that the answer is yes, and that this will be a major weapon in the battle against torture at the CIA sites. In fact, I believe that that will be the case, and that our leadership will come through on this. But there is a minor detail in here that has certain implications that were not discussed in council today, that have not been discussed at all, that I think we as psychologists need to know, because this resolution throws out Principle A of the Ethics Code. In the list of the techniques on lines 97 to 98, it says an isolation, sensory, this is a list of banned techniques, isolation, sensory, and or sleep deprivation, used in a manner that represents, that changes severe to significant pain or suffering, or in a manner that a reasonable person would judge to cause lasting harm. So all of a sudden, the APA has voted that it is not unethical to cause any level of harm less than significant pain or suffering, or something that does not cause lasting harm. This, I think, is a black day for the profession of psychology and for ethics in psychology.
My name is Mike Wessels, and I just wanted to say that we're talking about a lot of the particulars of the resolution, which I think is terribly important. But we also have to look a little bit deeper at some of the core documents. You may not be aware of it, but if you read carefully the APA Code of Ethics, which was not sculpted to address international issues, one finds a discrepancy, a contradiction, that actively undermines psychologists' commitments to international human rights standards. It goes like this. We support human rights principles of beneficence and non-maleficence. Do no harm. So far, so good. Continue reading down. When there is a conflict over ethics, the psychologist can take active steps to resolve. And if those steps don't provide an easy resolution, or maybe a difficult resolution, it is within the purview of the psychologist to follow national law. Well, the problem with that doesn't require a PhD in political science or international human rights to understand. The way that the Saddam Husseins of the world and the tyrants of the world get their warrant to torture is by saying national law trumps international human rights standards. The power of international human rights standards derives precisely from the fact that no state and no military can trump them. And yet this administration, the Bush administration, has chosen to establish a regime where it claims that national law and U.S. Policy trumps international human rights standards. And guess what? The APA has, you and I, we have not actively opposed it. We need to change the ethics code to bring ourselves in line with international human rights standards. The second point is that every time international human rights standards are compromised, it is not just that harm gets done, it is that the international movement to establish human rights standards are actively weakened. The APA took such a step today by ruling that psychologists could potentially continue to be active at Guantanamo Bay and at other sites operating outside the Geneva Conventions. The door was opened for the sanctioning of psychologists operating in direct contravention of international human rights standards. To hold people in indefinite detention without recourse, without any civil and political rights, is itself a form of torture and abuse. Just to finish up, my question that I would add, along with the good question Stephen raised, is what is the association going to actively do to stop fiddling around with relatively minor resolutions when it's not even on the path of actively supporting international human rights standards in everything that it does? It's at perilous, at grave peril of making international human rights standards a matter of rhetoric than of action. And that's the wrong stance.
My name is William Todd Mancias from Chico State. I have a brief observation, a simple observation. If we want to follow ethics that are more closely aligned with what we would accept as an internationally bona fide paradigm, why not endorse in language as close to the Geneva Convention as possible all those particulars concerning what can and cannot be done with the treatment of detainees? It strikes me that it's a very, very possibly a preferred course of action because that is language that is well known internationally. And I'm also quite pleased with the fact that the administration tries to rewrite that language every chance it gets. So that's a pretty good litmus test that it must be okay.
I'm concerned that there's. My name is Ruth Blizzard. I'm from Boulder, Colorado. Ruth Blizzard from Boulder, Colorado, and I was 25 years in Binghamton, New York. I'm concerned that there's a certain amount of double talk and double think going on here in terms of what APA is saying it supports. The speaker a few minutes ago said that APA condones psychologists who consult on rapport building interrogation. Well, it so happens that there was an excellent investigative reporting series of articles in the Christian Science Monitor just this week on the treatment of Jose Padilla, who has been kept in solitary confinement for over 2 years, and on the effect that this solitary confinement has had on his mental state, and this is before the court now. One of the points that was made was that the proponents of using solitary confinement contend that it is a rapport building technique of interrogation, and that the solitary confinement causes the subject to want to talk more with his captors. If psychologists are permitted to consult on the use of solitary confinement to build rapport, then I don't even want to have a license as a psychologist. Thank you.
My name is Diane Ehrensaft, and this is Ruth Fallenbaum, and we're going to speak together as part of the Coalition for an Ethical APA, and Ruth is going to speak first.
the issues around section 301, or whichever, now I've forgotten what the section was, 1.02, which has been my obsession for the last year, and the entire changes in the ethics code from 2002, all the language and the missing clauses, the changed words, the resolutions, the amendments, the votes, the machinations, have led me to feel very strongly that there needs to be some house cleaning and some exploration and investigation into the ethics, the whole ethics apparatus of the APA. The fact that it has taken, the press, it has taken a ragtag bunch of busy psychologists to bring even the resolution that we're getting, which is sort of flawed, when we've got someone apparently, paid to do ethics, a whole committee of ethics people for the APA, who have given such poor consultation to this organization and have led us into this abyss of shame and, just something we ought to feel absolutely appalled by, I think means that we need some house cleaning here. And I don't know how that's going to do it, but that has to be our next project. And that has to be something that we hope you'll join us with.
And I'd like to tell you my personal story as a fellow member of APA. When I read the first resolution that was put out by APA, and I'm on a listserv, my immediate knee-jerk response is, I'm quitting. I do not want to be part of this organization. And then my colleagues calmed me down and said, no, don't quit, but let's think about what we want to do. So we did. And the first thing we did was decide to withhold our dues in protest and organize a group to withhold dues. And we all wrote letters, and in my personal letter, I talked about being Jewish and having been born in the 1940s and having learned never again that we are not going to allow people to be maltreated against their human rights and that it was our collective responsibility to stop it whenever we could. So from there, we went on to form the Coalition for an Ethical APA. And I believe that our coalition has been responsible for the forward movement in this resolution, but it's not good enough. And we have a lot more work to do. When I read the amendment, and I won't read it to you again, I see it's clear and simple. It is unethical to be a psychologist in an unethical setting that violates international human rights. There is no place for us there. As a clinical psychologist, when I'm with a patient, I pay attention to distortions. Why is somebody hearing something so different than how it was said? Which is what I heard at the council meeting this morning in terms of the interpretation of this amendment. And I would also like to ask people to think about why did that happen? Mostly, I would like you all to join our coalition. We have a lot more work to do, as you can hear in this town meeting. And we need all of us together who raised our hands yes on the amendment to keep working. And the more of us who work together, the more strength we will have to change this into an ethical APA. Thank you.
Your website.
EthicalAPA.com.
Neil Massoff again. Of all the boards and committees that I currently serve on and have served on at APA, my proudest moment as a psychologist were my 3 years on the Ethics Committee. I'm a former member, so I want to just say that first. One of the last speakers referred to, quotes, all of the changes that have been made since the 202 Ethics Code. There have been no changes made. The Ethics Committee, just so I'm understanding the process, people, let's not confuse the administration and the APA Ethics Committee, and I think some of that's going on. The Ethics Committee does not have the power to rewrite the Ethics Code. the other committee probably wishes they could insert some language in 1.02. It would solve some problems. The Ethics Committee cannot rewrite the Ethics Code. When the membership of APA decides that the time has come for a new Ethics Code, committees are brought together, and there is a whole process. It's out for public comment. It goes out for public comment again. It's a multi-year process. The Ethics Committee cannot rewrite the Ethics Code. There have been no changes made since the 2002 Ethics Code, and I just get furious when I hear people assume that the Ethics Committee is running around doing this stuff. The Ethics Committee is a voluntary committee, like everyone else. There's a small staff that works ridiculous numbers of hours, and the Ethics Committee are a bunch of volunteers like all the rest of us. No one is paid. So there needs to be some changes made. The Ethics Code is not thought about international law. The section that refers to when there's conflict between law and the Ethics Code, go with law, was written because our Ethics Code says you can sleep with patients after 2 years, even though I'm not so sure that's a good idea, cautions you to think about the patient and doing no harm. But there are some states that say you gotta wait longer. So you have to go with your state in violation of our Ethics Code. That's why that's there. It's not to protect people. It was not done for subterfuge to allow people to go out and do unethical things. Well, we're living in a different era, and there probably needs to be some changes made. And my guess is that the new Ethics Code, written by you folks, not by the little old Ethics Committee or the Ethics Office, will look a little bit different, and I think that's a positive thing. And I just wanted to explain the process and be supportive of our very hardworking Ethics Committee and Ethics Office.
I'm Jancis Long. I'm an officer of Psychologists for Social Responsibility and a member of Ethical APA. I would like to see this become more of a town meeting, and I would like to challenge those people in the APA who wrote the very admirable language and passed the very admirable language in the resolution that was passed this morning to square it with turning down the very moderate language in the amendment, which did not say there could be no psychologists present. They said there could be no psychologists involved in anything other than health work at these sites. I would like to ask the APA why they thought to turn this down at this point, and those members who did. And furthermore, I would like to ask whether they consider that it is now ethical for psychologists to be present and to be there at these interrogations, because it would seem that turning this down is saying that it is allowed. And to me, it seems that it is entirely in contrast to all the language of the resolution that was passed this morning. I challenge the APA to answer the questions of the last four speakers, including this one. Thank you.
Frank Summers, I'm a psychologist from Chicago. First of all, I want to respectfully disagree with some of the statements that have been made. The fact is that 2 years ago, the Council of Representatives voted to change the Ethics Code. They called on the Ethics Office to change the code. Nothing has been done. Okay? So that clarifies something that people should understand. Okay? At the beginning of this meeting, somebody said, you know, clarify for us what the vote was this morning. Okay? And I think people should understand that 102, which is a basic source of conflict for many of us, as speakers have said very articulately, does allow one to follow orders and violate the Ethics Code under that condition. But there was language in this amendment, as I saw it yesterday, that said that this would contravene any law or any order given. I don't see that in here today. How did that get taken out? When did that get taken out? Why did that get taken out? Now, with regard to the amendment itself, we were told at the beginning of this meeting that the amendment said there is no participation at all. That's not what the amendment says. Any of you can read it. It says that under conditions in which liberties are violated, people don't have basic human rights, you can participate only as a healthcare personnel in promoting healthcare services or providing healthcare services. It does not say you can't be involved. Okay? Now, my question is, how is it possible to be ethically involved in a situation where there are no basic human rights, where there is no due process, where there are none of the protections of the law that we enjoy here.
Oh.
We didn't do it.
Well, who did? We want some accountability. I mean, everyone in APA says we didn't do it. It wasn't us.
That's what we always say, right? We didn't do it.
Keep talking.
Yeah,
okay.
Keep talking.
Should I keep talking? Okay. So the argument was made this morning that the reason to turn it down, the primary reason, is because we have to be involved, okay? And we have to be involved because we make these interrogations safe and ethical and legal. I urge all of you to read a study that was done by the United Nations. The United Nations Commission studied Guantanamo, and what they said was that there was widespread use of techniques that amount to torture under international law, that healthcare personnel were complicit in the use of those techniques, and that they had a deleterious effects on the mental health of those people. And that there were, in the year 2003 alone, over 350 acts of self-harm. There were massive suicide attempts. There were massive hunger strikes. Where were the psychologists? Where were these psychologists that are making these interrogations safe, ethical, and legal? Thank you.
My name is Steve Behnke. I'm director of the Ethics Office at the American Psychological Association. I'd just like to respond to Dr. Summers, with whom I've had a number of conversations. I'd first like to respond to Len Rubenstein, if Len is still here. And, you know, Len has provided the APA a number of very helpful materials that are related to this issue. And Len has once again, as he has been doing for 2 years, offered his assistance on this issue, and we will be very grateful, as we have been, to accept it. We don't always see completely eye to eye, but we're grateful, and Len has shown an enormous amount of personal commitment to this issue and has provided, I think at this point, 12 or 15 letters to APA on this issue. So thank you for your offer. We will absolutely accept that. The second thing I'd like to say is that Dr. Summers said that counsel had directed the Ethics Committee to change Ethical Standard 1.02. In fact, that is not correct. That is not what counsel directed the Ethics Committee to. And I would really just encourage people, please read these texts. You must read the texts. And I would just read from a text that was just passed this morning. I know that everyone, it's clear that there is much difference of opinion about what APA should do, but please do read this document. I hope I can say that it is a positive step in the right direction. I know that it does absolutely not go as far as many people think APA ought to go, but I do think I can say on behalf of the association that we can all agree it is a step in the right direction. And I just want to read one passage from that. It says, the passage I like to read says that, "Be it resolved, the American Psychological Association affirms that there are no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether induced by a state of war or threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency that may be invoked as a justification for torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, including the invocation of laws, regulations, and orders."
Point of order. Steve, does that trump 1.02 in the case of torture?
It's very clear. There is no.
I just want you to know because the ethics code.
No justification.
Okay. What about CIA black sites? Enhanced interrogation at CIA black sites.
That's
The list that was contained in the resolution had two sources. One source, again, was a letter that Len Rubenstein had written, executive director of Physicians for Human Rights, to the APA, The other source was a program that was out here that Uwe Jacobs was kind enough to invite me to participate in on a panel at Survivors International. The other panelist was Professor Alfred McCoy, and I'm quite sure that many of you are familiar with Professor McCoy's book, A Question of Torture. And what Professor McCoy does, and what he did on that Saturday morning here at the Wright Institute, was he laid out a history of torture, and he said that if you take a look, there are certain techniques that appear, that continue to surface across time and across context. And then he specified what those techniques are. And they bear a very close resemblance to the specific techniques that Len Rubenstein wrote to the APA saying you must identify these specific techniques as constituting torture. Now, on that panel on that Saturday morning, I asked a question that I wanted to know. It seemed to me that torture and abusive treatment are limited only by the human imagination. So why would you have a specific list? And the answer came back, and I know Dr. Fallenbaum was there, a number of folks here were there, said that no, in fact, if you take a look at the history, we can get a good deal of specificity about the kind of techniques that we are talking about. And the message came across very clearly from both Professor McCoy and for the audience that APA's next step must be to specify specific techniques that are always prohibited. That's what APA did this morning. But I also want to be very clear that if you look at the language of the resolution, and again, I hope that everyone reads it, what it says is that this unequivocal condemnation includes all techniques defined as, and then it says, this unequivocal condemnation includes but is by no means limited to, so that there are specific techniques identified, but that is not a closed set, very explicitly not a closed set. One final point about the resolution, again, just encourage people to read it, but the Ethics Committee has been directed by counsel. It says, be it resolved that the APA Ethics Committee shall proceed forthwith in writing its casebook and commentary that shall set forth guidelines for psychology that are consistent with international human rights instruments. And then it actually specifies what those instruments are. The first is Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. One of the things, the points in the discussion this morning that the chair of the Ethics Committee made very clear is that this issue is at the center of APA's radar screen, and it is going to remain at the center for a very long time to come. And in writing the casebook and the commentary, the Ethics Committee is going to reach out to APA, to members, and to you to get your involvement in that process. We realize that this has been an enormously difficult time for the association, that we want this process to be as open, as transparent, and as participatory as it possibly can be. And the Ethics Committee is going to do that. And the Ethics Committee is going to look for your involvement, and we're going to come and seek you out in that process.
Would you answer one question?
Pardon?
Will this be in the APA Monitor
features and comments? Well, it can be, it will be in the APA Monitor. It will also be up on the APA website. And one of the things that the Ethics Committee is going to be talking about, and I know that there's been discussion about the Ethics Code revision. Dr. Massoff talked about that, but I can say as being part of that revision process, when the 1992 code was revised, that was a process that went on for a period of 5 years. The current language in Ethical Standard 102 was written in the fall of 2000, before September 11th, before the terrorist attacks. It bore no relationship whatsoever to this administration, to the global war on terror. Those are two completely separate issues. The language was already set at that point in time. But we went through 7 revisions
We had repeated requests to have comments on it. We put those in the APA monitor. We set up a website so people could visit it and come and give their comments directly. And we had the entire drafts printed in the monitor for commentary. And absolutely, we will recreate that process for the casebook and commentary. We want it to be as open and as participatory as it can possibly be. Would you answer? You know, I don't know the origin of that rule. I simply don't know it, but...
Why don't you know?
Why don't I know that rule? That is an excellent question. I don't know. But here's someone who does know that rule. But let me also point out that when we were requested to change the rule was changed. But
Dr. Fink, can I ask one question for you?
Actually, I think I'm going to let it be a part of it.
I can just speak to the cameras rule, and it really has to do with the space access and fairness issue. We often have less space for cameras than we have crews wanting into a session. So in fairness, we try to rotate every 10 or 15 minutes to allow crews to come in. That's not the case in this room, so the rule was changed and everyone has to allow.
I think you need to change the rule permanently.
It's not been the case in any room in this whole convention.
It was my pleasure to wait, and I'll tell you why. I find it very frightening to be sitting in the room now where the last speaker is the only person who's speaking in favor of what was voted on this morning. There's an entire audience of people here who are not happy with the resolution or would like to see things that are very different. And I find it very frightening that the very people who voted for that overwhelmingly somehow now feel that they no longer need to participate in public in this process. And that's very scary. And I hope that will not be the case.
Hi, I'm Ghislaine Boulanger. I'm not going to take up a whole lot of time. Along with Ruth Fallenbaum and Diane Aronsoft and Martha Davis, who's not here, we started this movement to withhold APA dues. And really, it is so wonderful to be here today after the very alienating, as I experienced this morning when the proposed amendment was voted down. By a vast majority voted down. To hear so many of you clearly feeling that you would have passed it and indicating that you would have. And I want to suggest that perhaps you join us in pledging to withhold your 2008 and 2009 dues until an amendment like this is passed. Furthermore, we have a listserv where you can communicate with us and with your ideas, and it is withholdapadues.com. Some of us are wearing these blue ribbons. We will be happy to give you the number again. But we really, really urge you to join us. It is a listserv. It's an open discussion about these issues. Thank you. Well, that's right. You have to agree to withhold your dues in order to be on the listserv. That is absolutely right. That is the purpose of it. That is absolutely the purpose of it, so that we who agree to withhold our dues can consider, for instance, how to pass this amendment.
I'm here as a guest, and I spoke before briefly, so I think I have the remainder of my 2 minutes. And I just want to say that I'm looking at this from the outside, and I notice that everyone in the organization has more power than the leadership. And I'm noticing that, you know, it's not clear what's going on with the leadership, but I know you have more power because the leadership was saying no reporters for more than 10 minutes, and I asked people to raise their hands, and when it was seen that, you know, the consensus, pretty much everyone approved of the reporting, it was immediately said, okay, let's allow the reporting. And so when people disagree with leadership, you have a couple of choices. You can oppose the leadership. It said that the best way to defeat what is bad, which is a general term, is to go forward in what is good. Or you can go forward and you can do what you want to do because you are more people, you have more energy, and it's just natural that you have more power. And I don't know what the group is for people to collect if they want to say, look, we are the members of the APA, and this is what we resolve, whether it's the ethical APA, you know, the withholding dues, that's bound to be controversial. But I just want to say, if everyone gets together and declares your voice, that's the voice of the most power.
I'm Hannah Lerman. I identify primarily as a feminist psychologist, and personally was involved in not the most current ethics code revision, but the two previous ones, and feel like I contributed a lot to the fact that it is now unethical, listed specifically unethical, to sleep with your clients. I was a member of council at that time, and I have some knowledge of the APA structure, although I'm not currently in any position of power. I was moved to speak by the question that came up about why the vote in this room was so different from the council vote. I know that since then the process has moved in a whole bunch of other directions, but I would like to respond to that, because if we're beginning to talk about how APA might be changed, I think that raises one particular issue. The members of council are elected by divisions and state organizations. If you are not a, if you are an APA, most of more than 50, most, I think much more than 50% of APA members do not belong to either one of those. And they therefore really have no vote on council. That's, you know, so I have heard APA described at various times, one as Byzantine, with structures being formed on structures. More apt to me, however, was regarding the APA structure as an amoeba. You can poke one of the pseudopods and it responds, but the action doesn't translate into the whole rest of the structure. So either we have to talk about whether you want to work on a large process of changing how APA members are represented in the larger organization, in the governance of the organization, or you need to join the subdivisions through which you can make your vote known. Those are, I mean, they're two different ways of doing it, and they're both possible. The other point that I wanted to make, however, someone was talking earlier that we were scientists. This, you know, neither the vote of council nor the vote in this room is a scientific vote.
My name is Nathaniel Raymond. I work for Physicians for Human Rights, and I didn't plan on speaking today because, as you can see, Len Rubenstein does a heck of a job on his own. But I wanted to make one point today, which is, we've been talking a lot about what's happening in here, and by here I mean the American Psychological Association. I want to speak to the larger context of what's happening out there. And my colleague Len Rubenstein mentioned, there's an investigative process going on in Washington in the Senate, and there is a series of disclosures which have happened in the media and also through the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Defense. The point I want to make is just to be clear about what we're talking about. We're not talking about bad apples. We're not talking about psychologists who are acting independently or individuals within the chains of command of CIA or DOD acting independently. We're talking about a government which since after September 11th has created a systematic regime of psychological torture with the assistance of mental health professionals and mental health expertise. While we're glad to see the resolution passed today, and we look forward to working with Dr. Banky and the rest of the APA, I really want to keep the focus on what happens out there. And I hope that we can really see today as the beginning of a change for APA from passing a resolution to becoming advocates for the end of what is not simply unethical, but illegal. The language that was passed in reference to the tactics is not exactly as we had initially written it from PHR. Be that as it may, we feel that from a legal and ethical perspective, one message has to be clear. These tactics prohibit what we know of the CIA Enhanced Interrogation Program. Let's not see this as an end. Let's see this as a platform. Let's put the rocket ship on the platform and take off. And where does that go? Well, that goes one way. The APA needs to advocate actively in Washington to say psychologists and psychological expertise cannot be used as a weapon that violates the law, the ethics, and the human convention.
Sarah Sand, and I'll actually be brief. I just want to read a few sentences and pose a question after those sentences. On May 18, 2007, the Office of the Inspector General of the Department of Defense released its investigative report. It was declassified. And to my knowledge, it's the only place where there's actually an indication that psychologists perhaps have been involved in the development of these techniques. And I will read you directly from that report. None of these words are mine. Between June and July 2002, the Chief of Staff of the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency, the agency responsible for organizing SEER training, working with the Army Special Operation Command's Psychological Directorate, developed a plan designed to teach interrogators how to exploit high-value detainees. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in September 2002 recommended that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Behavioral Science Unit, the Army's Behavioral Science Consultation Team, and the Southern Command Psychological Operations Support Element, the group at Gitmo, and JTF 170 clinical psychologists develop a plan to exploit detainee vulnerabilities. Once again, this is the government speaking, not me. The JTF, on September 16th, 2002, the Special Army Operations Command and the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency co-hosted a SEER psychologist conference for JTF 170 interrogation personnel. The Army's Behavioral Science Consultation Teams, those biscuits, from Guantanamo Bay also attended the conference. The JTF 170 personnel understood that they were to become familiar with SEER training and be capable of determining which SEER information and techniques might be useful in interrogations at Guantanamo. Guantanamo Behavioral Science Consultation Team personnel understood that they were to review documentation and standard operating procedures for SEER training in developing the standard operating procedure for the JTF 170 if the command approved those practices. They also supported a SEER psychologist competency area. My question is, why has APA not addressed exactly what is said in this report, which does indicate that there has been some psychological involvement in these practices?
Because I had time to speak before, I'm going to be very brief. I wanted to thank Dr. Banky for showing up and answering questions. And I have a very simple question about
this resolution that has just passed. If I am a member of a DISCUT that is working under the direction of the CIA, and I am told to waterboard somebody, and I have made efforts to resolve the conflict between this resolution and the what I believe to be U.S. law, may I then choose to adhere to U.S. law and therefore waterboard?
You may not.
No.
It is unethical. It's prohibited and it's sanctioned.
So I cannot say.
My name is Aaron Schumann. I coordinate something called the Prisoner Solidarity Project at Prison Activist Resource Center. And this is a folder of complaints about torture and mistreatment that we've received from one state prison. I've also done time for protesting at the School of the Americas and have had the privilege of going across the country with former torture survivors from El Salvador and members of Torture Abolition Survivors and Support Coalition. So my first question in sitting in on the discussion about the resolution today is, why was it strictly limited to enemy combatants and not raising the issue of conditions in prisons in the U.S. and detention centers in the U.S.? One of the things that we do for the Prisoner Solidarity Project is mail in the U.N. minimum standard rules for the minimum standard treatment of prisoners, which we know the U.S. violates. We know the New Jersey American Friends Service Committee has a long-standing campaign talking about maximum security prisons as torture, talking about things when people talk about things like solitary confinement, talk about things like sensory deprivation, talk about things like isolation, talk about things like being denied food, shelter. You know, those are all things that I read letters about every day from prisoners inside the U.S. There's an article by a professor named Alian Eladio Gomez on the Marion Control Unit, which was one of the first maximum security prisons, if not the first, inside the U.S., where he talks about a Bureau of Prisons seminar that was conducted called Breaking Men's Minds back in the early 60s, and talks about in a way that's very compatible with the argument that Alfred McCoy makes about psychological torture in the book that was mentioned earlier, about what is going on inside U.S. prisons and maximum security prisons every day. So my question is, why is the American Psychological Association being so conservative that it's only talking about enemy combatants, and I didn't hear anything about prison conditions or conditions in detention centers inside the U.S.? Just to rattle off a few things very quickly, we know in Chicago, reported by the Chicago Reader, a case of systematic police torture for a generation that Richard Daley is implicated in. We know just down the street at 850 Bryant, there are former Black Panthers being held who were tortured into confessing and whose torturers were rehired by the Department of Justice to investigate them decades later. We know from a book a writer Mark Dow did called American Gulag on the condition on detention centers inside the U.S. that took almost 10 years of research that about the conditions that go on inside. So I would challenge people as part of this discussion that it really needs to be widely opened up. In the state of California, you already have the state prison system in federal receivership. You already have the healthcare system in federal receivership. And you already have doctors, environmental professionals raising the issue that the prison system is a public health crisis, that constructing more prisons will create a health crisis. And you have statistics from things like the Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons that says 1.5 million people
You'll
get cycled through the prison and jail.
Stop when your time is up.
Well, I'm on my last sentence.
You're right, but you should stop when everybody else stops.
Okay, but I'm not interested in being right. I'm interested in changing the situation.
But we're also interested in hearing other people who are waiting and keeping to the time limit.
Thank you.
About conditions in U.S. jails and prisons and U.S. correctional facilities.
of all the APA governance groups that reviewed what was originally the moratorium resolution, it was the Committee on Ethnic and Minority Affairs that said that any resolution must speak more broadly than simply detainees. It must look at how people, and in particular, people of color, are treated in U.S. jails and prisons. And that is right up on the APA website. The Committee on Ethnic and Minority Affairs speaks directly to your point.
I want to observe we have 5 minutes left and four people lined up to speak. If you can be very, very brief, everybody will be able to do it.
Why does this always happen to me?
Wait, no, is there something else in the room? Can we stay till the four people are done?
I've looked at the text. We're told to look at the text of the resolution, and I've come to the conclusion that the winner today were the people who backed the QBARC style of interrogation, and the losers today were those who backed the SEER style of interrogation, and the playing field was the APA. The SEER, the resolution which condemns a number of different types of participation in different techniques of torture that were absolutely banned, which as Dr. DeMakey pointed out, was waterboarding, rape, simulated drowning, mock executions, cultural and religious humiliation. These were the landmark techniques of the SEER style of interrogation and torture. QBARC, which means CIA, which developed over a period of 50 years a style of torture, is based on sensory deprivation, isolation, hypnosis, and the induction of debility, including sleep deprivation. You'll see that division in the resolution because those things are not prohibited as conditions of detention. They're prohibited as conditions of to be used in interrogations. But you see, they don't use sleep deprivation while they're interrogating you. They use it before they interrogate you as part of the conditions of detention to soften you up for the interrogation. So the winner today, and I'm sure their lawyers are very happy, is the CIA. And I think that's why it is so important to see how the APA is going to react to the question of the enhanced interrogation techniques. But I would say, not just the interrogation techniques, but the entire use of these techniques in the enhanced, in the secret sites, including the detention conditions, because otherwise it's a farce.
Thank you.
My name is Jack Sawyer. I'm curious about the process here. I wonder how many members of the board of directors are here with us.
One, to be commended.
For that, there are how many on the board? A dozen or more?
13.
I'm curious if, why the others aren't here. They weren't instructed not to come, I'm sure. Were they invited to come? Do you have any idea? You're here probably because you were conducting the meeting. But why aren't your fellow board members here to hear the town hall?
President Sharon was here earlier. Others weren't here. Our president of APA was here, and I think that just should be said. I saw her.
Good. The president was here, and one other board member was here earlier.
President-elect,
yes. Al Kasten, right. Good for Al. Do you have any thoughts as to why so few had interest in this?
Well, you are asking me a question
I know another unanswerable question, but you're asking me why people who aren't here aren't here. And I have no advance knowledge anyone was not planning to come or planning to come. I didn't poll them to see who was coming. It's not really a board event. It's a town hall meeting for you.
Is it for us? Or is it, it's not to help the board get to the idea of the opinions of people?
Conrad, I've gotten a lot of ideas about your opinions. And I will convey them, I hope, faithfully to my board colleagues.
Well, you've got a big job. Good luck.
I'm Bram Friedhandler. I'm a San Francisco psychologist, and I'm also a member of the California Psychological Association Ethics Committee. And I just want to make the point that that I think a lot of our experience dictates that so much depends, that ultimately everything depends in a situation like this on interpretation and implementation. You know, we have a resolution that was passed that we're only just now getting a chance to read. There seem to be, from what I've heard, elements of it that are really disappointing to me personally and to people who've paid the closest attention to this issue. But there also seems to be language in it that, at a very minimum, is interpretable as supporting a really progressive stance for this organization. And if the organization is pressured to implement those truly progressive interpretations of this language, then a great deal can be achieved. If that activity doesn't take place, then far less will be achieved. And that's, it seems to me, what ultimately everything depends on. We've heard that so clearly and so helpfully from the representatives from Physicians for Human Rights, who have really, you know, articulated a plan for us, it seems to me. And we can do much to learn from them. And the exchange that took place a minute ago, in which Dr. Benke was, well, the group was asked, and Dr. Benke responded, does 1.02, does the exception 1.02 permit a psychologist to violate the language of this resolution that's just passed and to participate in any of these activities? And we heard absolutely unequivocally that 1.02 does not permit that to happen, that such a psychologist would be behaving unethically by the official policy of this organization and would be sanctioned. That was a step forward to hear that so clearly stated, and I would say that we need to pressure and support and pressure the Ethics Committee, the Ethics Office, to produce the casebook, not only to consider it, but to produce it, as well as the Office of Governmental Affairs to do, as Physicians for Human Rights have said, to advocate in Washington for the spirit of this resolution.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Olson. I'm the chair for Divisions for Social Justice. We're 13 divisions of the American Psychological Association working together to put forth make sure that social justice becomes a central part, not just this ethics and interrogation issue, but absolutely every component of the APA. I wasn't going to talk today because there's such energy in here and so many people are talking, and I've been talking for so long. Stephen Reisner, Stephen Saltz, and I talked so much. I was standing in the room with Stephen Saltz the other day, and he was on the cell phone with his son, and said, son says, mom and I were talking, and we were so happy when we remember the days when Brad wasn't calling. But as psychologists, you know, everybody has been so tough and yet good-hearted in here today. But you know, as psychologists, we know that reinforcement increases the probability of behaviors, and we need to remain vigilant, and we need to make sure there's action on this, the good parts of this resolution that happened today. But we also need to reinforce the people who helped set up this mini convention within the APA and who are holding this town hall meeting. And sometimes funny things go on, 10 minutes with the camera, but some beautiful social action, nip that in the bud, and that's what we just need to keep on doing again and again and keep pushing through until the end. Now, today I was told that, I was just at a Division for Social Justice meeting, and I was told that I have very mixed feelings about what happened today. I think mostly positive. But a couple of council members said that they were threatening DSJ with removing the division because of our tactics. Well, I don't know what our tactics are other than authenticity and honesty. I mean, that's what we try to do. I mean, we've taken Linsky's rules and said, no, those are not right. But we need to keep pushing, and we need to just make sure that that we're positive too. And I would really like everybody to thank the APA members who are here, thanks the military who are going up at those different sessions in the mini conventions. It's not always easy to hear this for them, and I've learned a lot from them, and we all need to keep talking and keep working together. So let's thank Steve Banky and Josh and Vera.
Certainly in an evolutionary point in our discussion and in the process of all this. I appreciate your comments on behalf of the Board of Directors, and I appreciate your attendance at the other sessions during ethics and interrogation, confronting the challenge. Thanks for coming. Please feel free to stick around, mull around until the hotel asks you to go somewhere else. Olivia, last word.
Thank you very much, and we hope to see you at the remaining sessions of the series. Thank you.